Well, first, I really want to express my appreciation to Socialist Alternative in Australia for inviting me to be a part of your conference. This is a first for me, a first time to address and to talk with an audience in Australia. So it's a real honor for me to be a part of the event. Maybe I should begin with a little bit about the background to the book, and I'm glad you mentioned my Marx and Engels book that came out in 2000. And my argument is that Marx and Engels did more to advance the democratic quest in the 19th century more than any other two people, exactly because of the work they were doing with the working class, the really only democratic class in society, the efficacious Democrats. And in that book, I promise that I would look at what happened to their project after their deaths. And I promise that I would look at Lenin. And so the book, in many ways, is a fulfillment of my promise. And the book came out in 2014. And it was very pricey, almost embarrassingly pricey. And so I'm really, really grateful to the comrades at Haymarket Press for urging me to have it republished. And so it's a much more affordable copy. And so I'm very appreciative of Arnold at Haymarket Press. Yeah, the book is really a deep dive into Lenin's collective works. It's in that sense, it's not really original. It's all there in the 45 volumes. And so what I've done is to excavate what Lenin said on the question. And I should mention that when I conceived of the book, it was in the context of the Arab Spring and then the Occupy Wall Street movement. And it occurred to me that perhaps I should think about how those movements may be informed by Lenin's project, rather than do a general kind of book on Lenin's democratic credentials, to focus on what was the burning question for progressive forces around the world. That is, what is the relationship between the streets, being in the streets, and being in the electoral arena? And deep in my memory banks, I remembered reading a pamphlet that Pathfinder Press, the United States Socialist Workers Party, published in 1971, called Lenin as Campaign Manager. And it was in that little pamphlet that I first learned about Lenin's electoral activities. And so I went back and looked at the pamphlet, and indeed it was even more revealing. And so what my book in many ways does is to flesh out that pamphlet and to elaborate on something that Lenin said in his famous book, Left-Wing Communism, in 1920, in which he said that electoral parliamentary work was indispensable in the Bolshevik conquest in 1917. And so in many ways what I'm doing is providing the details of that claim. And also, too, in 1920, for the Second Congress of a Comintern, the theses on revolutionary parliamentarism highly distills the Bolshevik experience over the course of the four Dumas between 1906 and 1914, their participation in those four Dumas. That's what that thesis to the Second Congress of Comintern on revolutionary parliamentarism. So that's what I'm unfolding. That's what I'm unpacking. I had originally wanted to call the book Revolutionary Parliamentarism, but I realized that most people would not know what parliamentarism means today. It was a common term at the beginning of the 20th century. Everybody knew what it meant, but today it's we don't use it. So I sort of bent a bit and termed the title on Lenin's electoral strategy, which was a bit misleading in many ways. So the title that we adopted at Haymarket is really a much more appropriate title. And so so in that sense, the book is not original with regard to what's in it with regard to Lenin. Again, it's all there in the 45 volumes. It's not something in some hidden archives, although it was interesting along the way. I learned that according to the Leninologist Robert Service, the 45 volumes really is about a tenth. There's only about a tenth of all of Lenin's writings, and his writings have never been fully translated. And so that's a whole wealth of information that someone really should look into. There was a another Leninologist by the name of Richard Pipes, who got a chance to look at a lot of the things that have never been published. And it was good that Pipes did, because Pipes was no friend of Lenin. And he put together what he called the unknown Lenin, documents that had never found their way into the 45 volumes. But the documents that he unearthed really don't provide the smoking gun that many anti-Leninists were looking for, thinking that there was some skeletons in Lenin's closet that would be revealed. And if Pipes, believe me, if Pipes couldn't find anything that was a smoking gun, we don't really have to be worried that there's something that we don't know about Lenin and all of the unpublished materials. But yes, it's all in the 45 volumes. All right. I think the only original contributions I make are two. One, I think I'm the first person who connects the dots between the strategy and tactics of Marx and Engels with regard to electoral parliamentary work and what Lenin does. Even in Trotsky's magisterial history of the Russian Revolution, Trotsky doesn't make that connection between what Marx and Engels were doing and what Lenin was doing. And it may have been simply for the fact that Trotsky may not have been aware of Marx and Engels' work with regard to electoral parliamentary work, or maybe he simply didn't know, wasn't intimately familiar, certainly, with what Lenin had been doing around electoral parliamentary work. Remember that he and Trotsky and Lenin were bitter opponents for about 12 years before Trotsky came back and became a Bolshevik in April, May of 1917. So it's possible Trotsky simply didn't know that about this very, very rich history. So I think that's the one of the original contributions, is to make the connection between Marx and Engels' historical program. And the best place to begin, and I argue with Marx and Engels on this topic, is their 11-page document called The Address to the of a central of the Communist League Central Authority in March of 1850. It's only 11 pages, but extremely rich. And we know that Lenin committed it to memory. He loved reciting the 1850 address. And my argument is that the 1850 address, in many ways, is the playbook for Lenin in 1917. So that's one of the claims that I'm making, and I think that's original. The second original contribution is a concept I've come up with based upon Lenin's writings and also Marx and Engels, and that is the notion of voting fetishism. And what I mean by voting fetishism is the mistaken belief that when you vote, you're exercising power. My claim is no, that's not what you're doing. What you're doing is registering a preference for either a candidate or a particular policy. It's an important democratic right, oftentimes won in struggle or the threat of struggle, but it's not the exercising of power. And to confuse the two is to engage in what I call voting fetishism. And the concept, as far as I can tell, is original, but it's inspired by Lenin's critique of Karl Kautsky and Kautsky's understanding about what the Bolsheviks had and had not done. And it's also inspired, my concept of voting fetishism is also inspired by Marx and Engels' notion, one that Lenin loved to employ, parliamentary cretinism. Parliamentary cretinism is the mistaken belief that what takes place in the parliamentary arena is the be-all and end-all of politics. And that's a concept, again, that Marx and Engels first employed, and looking at the 1848 revolutions, especially within Germany, and Lenin loved to employ the concept. And I suspect that had Marx and Engels lived long enough to see the electoral process, and they would have indeed come up with a similar kind of term to critique the assumption that when you vote, you're actually exercising power. So that's the only two, what I think are the original contributions I make in the book. And we can have a discussion and get into more details about it, about the contents of the book. Thank you.
Okay, well, I just want to start again by thanking Olga so much for joining us to talk about all of this. I think his book is really excellent, as Jasmine said, as are his other works. I think the makes a big contribution to our understanding of these questions and of the practice of the Bolsheviks. You know, firstly, as August went through, the way that the Bolsheviks used their revolutionary parliamentary work to aid in their goal of forging a successful workers' revolution. And secondly, and as he started to talk about, I think... you know, very relevant for many of the debates on the left in recent years and decades, really. His whole account in the book is, I think, a really well-documented and, I think, very devastating takedown, actually, of parliamentary cretinism and done through the words of himself, but also of Marx, Engels and Lenin. I think that's very valuable and much needed on the left today. And it's important to see how those two things go together, because without getting the question of how to approach the electoral work right, well, the Bolsheviks' electoral work, instead of aiding a process of actual workers' successful revolution and uprising, you know, would have done the opposite, as it has done in so many other socialist organizations, you know, dragged them to the right, ended up capitulating and so on. I just wanted to, I guess, reiterate some of the points that August just made and flesh them out a bit. And people should take this as an extended and very... supportive review of his book, basically, because it's pretty much all in there, and I very much encourage everyone to read it. I mean, the starting point for Marx and Engels and for Lenin, of course, is that they were revolutionaries, that they, you know, while they fought, of course, for the deepest possible democratic victories under capitalism, they always conceived of this not as the end of the matter, you know, but as the beginning of a whole process to then fight for workers' power and socialism. And they thought that, you know, democracy, even bourgeois democracy, created the best possible conditions for the open struggle between capitalists and workers, and then for the best situation in which the working class itself could become class conscious, could be organized to actually, you know, wage a successful revolution. And so Marx, of course, argued that the existing state machinery cannot be wielded by the working class. Instead, it has to be smashed. And he was inspired above all by the Paris Commune of 1871, which for him began to show the way in which workers could organize themselves as a new revolutionary state power. Engels argued, to quote him, to say, you know, universal suffrage is the gauge of the maturity of the working class. It cannot and never will be anything more in the present day state. But that is sufficient. On the day the thermometer of universal suffrage registers boiling point among the masses, among the workers, both they and the capitalists will know where they stand. So Engels is making the point there that, that's all universal suffrage can do. It can register, vaguely where the working class is at in terms of its consciousness, but it won't settle any of the key matters that workers need to fight for. For that, it would require a revolutionary battle. And Engels really ridiculed those who he described, which August just referred to, which he described as having caught that, quote, incurable malady, parliamentary cretinism, a disorder which penetrates its unfortunate victims with the solemn conviction that the whole world, its history and its future, is governed and determined by a majority of votes in that particular representative body which has the honour to count them among its members. And in Lenin's words, similarly, he said that even the most democratic republics remain dictatorships of the capitalists. As August said, he really spent a lot of time critiquing one of the key theoreticians of reformism, one of the most left-sounding theoreticians of reformism in Europe at the time, who was Karl Kautsky. And Lenin argued that his great mistake was to imagine that extremely important political problems can be solved by voting. Whereas such problems are actually solved by civil war. They spent their whole lives fighting for this kind of revolutionary approach against their opportunist rivals, including, and this is important, I think, even in Marx and Engels' cases, being prepared to split organisationally from the reformists because they saw this as such a key dividing line, is their whole approach to how socialism could be brought about and so on. So this meant, as August said, that the parliamentary activity for these revolutionaries always had to be subordinate to other activity in the class struggle. And this is an approach, obviously, totally the opposite of, the reformists, the Bernsteins and Kautskys of the day, or think about, the Labour Party or the Greens or any of these parties today, for whom it's the opposite. They subordinate every other form of activity to their parliamentary success rather than the other way around. And it also meant that the parliamentarians themselves had to be actually subordinated to the revolutionary party. Again, totally foreign to the way that most parties are run, where it's the MPs who run the party. Well, no, Marx, Engels, Lenin all argued again and again that that was a road to selling out, to careerism, to parties being dominated, by electoralism instead of the other way around, instead of the electoral work being subordinated to the revolutionary work of the party itself. And, this is the main context within which the term democratic centralism was actually employed by Lenin. That's a term which has been much abused by Stalinists and so on to actually just justify authoritarianism in socialist organisations. But actually what Lenin was getting at whenever he used the term was that the members of the party have to be able to control the parliamentarians and they can't just do whatever they want sell out and betray the workers who have elected them. And NIMS and August documents really well a number of the occasions in which Marx and Engels weighed into debates in the SPD around all these questions, fought against the kind of opportunist leadership that was taking form in the SPD. He talks about the 1879 circular, for example, a letter that Marx wrote to a bunch of the leading SPD members, castigating them for the way that one of their parliamentarians had gone against party principles but was being defended effectively by the party. And someone within the SPD who had called them out on this was instead being shamed and denounced rather than actually that was the thing that needed to happen and more of it. Furthermore, Marx and Engels never conceived of parliamentary activity as being about actually trying to win majorities in bourgeois elections. This was a pretty ludicrous concept, I think, to them. And that was particularly true in their day when the working class, of course, was still a minority of the population. But even today, because bourgeois elections take place on such a right-wing terrain, it's not just workers who get to vote and all the rest of it, but also the whole terrain of atomised, individualised voting and all the rest of it. And I think that's an important point because, again, today you can see people conceive of, like, this is what electoral work should mean, is actually trying to win. And you see that with Bernie Sanders, and you can see the then lengths people go to try to conjure up how, revolutionaries supposedly could win parliamentary majorities or anything like it today. And Engels' conception was very much that, like, well, as if the capitalists would ever let revolutionaries, as if they'd ever let it get to that point where revolutionaries are winning majorities in elections. Well before that point, they would cancel, they would abolish parliamentary democracy. And that's, that's just about the actual vote taking place. But even more, think about the question of would a genuine revolutionary socialist party, you know, even if it won a Democratic majority in an election, ever be actually allowed to form government? And I think the answer is decisively no to that question. And you can see the times in history when left reformist parties have formed government. It's only when they've done some shady, usually backdoor deal to guarantee to the capitalist class that they won't actually challenge decisively, you know, their rule over society. So you think about, we just had a session on Chile in the 1970s, and the deal done there by the Allende government, again, secretly with the state apparatus to say we won't challenge any of the you know, core institutions of the state. And it was only on that basis that they were allowed to form government. Okay. So Marx and Engels' approach was informed, as August went through, by particularly by their experience of the 1848 revolutions, the betrayals of the bourgeoisie and the petty bourgeoisie in the fight for democracy in those situations, which led Marx and Engels to draw the very clear political conclusion that the working class forevermore had to be organised independently of the other classes, both organisationally and politically independently of the other classes, that only the working class would be the force that could push forward to fight even for democracy in any consistent way, let alone, of course, for socialism. And it's out of that that they drew, you know, some really useful lessons, as August said, about our approach to elections. And it's worth quoting some of the March address that August talked about, because it really spells this out, I think. So they wrote in that, and I quote, without talking about what, you know, how they should run in elections or whatever. And they said that workers' candidates should be nominated everywhere in opposition to bourgeois democratic candidates. As far as possible, they should be members of the Communist League, and their election should be pursued by all possible means. Even when there is no prospect of achieving their election, the workers must put up their own candidates to preserve their independence, to gauge their own strength, and to bring their revolutionary position and party standpoint to public attention. And they went on to critique lesser evilism. They talked about how they must not be led astray by the empty phrases of the Democrats, who will maintain that the workers' candidates will split the Democratic Party and offer the forces of reaction the chance of victory. All such talk means, in the final analysis, that the proletariat is to be swindled. The progress which the proletarian party will make by operating independently in this way is infinitely more important than the disadvantages resulting from the presence of a few reactionaries in the representative body. A really clear statement, I think, about the need to reject the kind of pressure on revolutionaries to basically shut up and toe the line behind some lesser evil party. Yeah, and you can see again from that their subordination of their electoral terrain to the bigger picture of trying to win class consciousness amongst the working class to take the actual struggle forward. Okay, and the point for Marx and Engels was not then to reach some kind of lowest common denominator electoral political bloc that might win an election. Far from it. Their goal actually was to split those kinds of political blocs which subordinated the working class to the bourgeois liberals. Okay, and this was an approach very much taken up by Lenin in Russia, and he took all the lessons from Marx and Engels and applied that to his fight within Russia for democracy and for socialism, and particularly that meant combating the Mensheviks, actually, in Russia. His whole argument was for a worker-peasant alliance, that was the way that the revolution could be carried out in Russia against the Mensheviks, who argued that the workers instead needed to look to the bourgeoisie to carry out the coming democratic revolution, and that the role of the working class had to be actually to subordinate itself to the bourgeoisie. And they said, you know, oh, the workers can't be too aggressive in their own demands, otherwise they will cause the bourgeoisie to recoil from the fight for democracy. So Lenin panned this very moderate approach of the Mensheviks. He said, for example, in 1907, that instead of acting as the ludicrous and shameful accomplices of the liberal landlords, a useful and responsible role awaits us, and that is to exercise the hegemony of the proletariat over the democratic petty bourgeoisie, in other words, the peasants mainly, in the struggle to prevent subordination of the unenlightened masses to the leadership of the liberals. So his whole argument was that within the workers' movement, we need to split people away from those who want to, you know, just tail along behind the liberals and the bourgeoisie. And similarly, the peasants also have to be broken from their support for the bourgeoisie. That they need to be won to support the workers and the working class fight for a revolution. And, yeah, and August documents really well how the Duma, the intervention into the Duma elections was a big part of how the Bolsheviks waged this argument amongst the masses of Russia. In particular, their approach to the cadets, you know, who were the key party of the kind of bourgeois liberalism in Russia. They talked about democracy and liberty and so on, but in practice, they were for always, you know, actually siding with Tsarism in the last instance against what they saw as the main threat of the working class struggle from below. So the Bolsheviks' approach, unlike the Mensheviks, was to ruthlessly expose all the betrayals of the Cadet Party, and the Duma work, again, was a key way that they did that. Instead, they put up consistently their key demands, this is their key three election electoral demands, which was for a republic, in other words, to actually abolish Tsarism, to go all the way in the fight for democracy on that front, for the eight-hour day, the key demand of the working class in Russia, and to expropriate the big landowners and give land to the peasants, essentially. So you can see encapsulating that, the key tasks of the Russian Revolution, the fight for democracy, the fight for workers' power, and the fight for land to the peasants, and using those interventions to try to build that worker-peasant alliance. And, you know, there's so many great tales about how the Bolsheviks used their Duma deputies, which they managed to get elected some of, and how they were embedded in the real struggles going on. Again, this was far from the approach of parliamentarians today in Labour parties or anything like that. These people were not separate from the class struggle. They were totally embedded in it. And one wonderful quote which sums this up is actually from an assistant to the Minister of the Interior in the Tsarist Duma, talking to one of the key Bolshevik deputies, a guy by the name of Badaev. And this is what he said to him. He said, "You are a deputy of the State Duma. Your business is to legislate. That is why you were elected. But instead, you spend your time at the workshops, hatching plots, issuing leaflets, and publishing a newspaper which incites its readers to criminal acts." And yeah, exactly. That should be the role of a revolutionary who finds their way into parliament. And there's, you know, so many great examples of, you know, they would use every intervention, basically, they would tie to some real struggle happening, mass strikes breaking out, political demands being raised by the workers in the factories, and so on. It was always tied to that. And in fact, if they didn't already have a mass organisation and a mass revolutionary newspaper, Pravda, you know, one of the points they made is that whatever we had said in the Duma, well, no one ever would have even heard about, because the bourgeois and the, you know, Tsarist press wasn't going to report actually on our great speeches. Yeah, so you needed actually a real mass organisation already existing in the workers' movement to make the most then and to actually be able to use the Duma effectively. Okay, and I'll sum up this bit by talking about, again, how different their approach was to, you know, the reformist parliamentary approach of the SPD and other parties. And a key moment was when the First World War broke out, you know, which we know was a key moment that split the socialist movement everywhere. The reformists supported the war, the revolutionaries opposed it. And this came out in how their parliamentarians behaved as well, of course. And Lenin summed up the key difference when he was talking about the heroic role actually played by, again, the Bolshevik Duma deputies. They opposed the war, they took a very principled stand, and for it they were, after some months, arrested, and they faced, you know, potentially the death penalty. But they did the right thing instead of betraying the working class as the reformists had. And I'll end on this great quote, which sums up the core difference in approach. So Lenin says, "Some utilize the parliamentary arena in order to win the favor of their governments, or at best to wash their hands of everything, like the Menshevik group. Others utilize parliamentarism in order to remain revolutionary to the end, to perform their duty as socialists and internationalists, even under the most difficult circumstances. The parliamentary activities of some bring them ministerial seats. The parliamentary activities of others bring them to prison, to exile, to penal servitude. Some serve the bourgeoisie, others the proletariat. Some are social imperialists, others are revolutionary Marxists." And that was the approach of the Bolsheviks to the Duma. And it meant it left very little room for the kind of careerism and self-serving activity that you see amongst so many sellout parliamentarians today. They were actually able to successfully use their Duma work for the cause of the revolution.
Yes, I'm glad. Yeah, Josh did an excellent job of summarizing certainly some of the things that I pointed to. I wanted to just to underscore the importance of the 1850 address. And again, for Marx and Engels, the elections were not an end in themselves, but a means to an end. They were, the purpose of elections for revolutionary socialists was to count one's forces, and secondly, to educate use elections as a way to educate and get out your ideas and your program. About counting, one of the things that was a big revelation for me in doing the research was how serious Lenin took counting. He had a penchant for statistics. He loved to analyze election returns. And he was so good at it. He made an argument for the elections to the second Duma in 1906 by analyzing the election returns from the first Duma, he was able to make a persuasive case, contrary to what the Mensheviks were saying. The Mensheviks claimed that if the Bolsheviks said, that is not the Bolsheviks, but if the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party ran its own candidates, it would allow the most reactionary forces known as the Black Hundreds, kind of incipient fascists, the Black Hundreds to win the elections. So this is really the first explicit debate in the annals of our movement about the lesser of two evil question. And if we run our own candidates, all you're doing is allowing the most reactionary forces to take power. So Lenin, of course, went back to what Marx and Engels said in the 1850 address on this. But what Lenin was able to do was to go back and analyze the elections for the first Duma, and to argue that if the Russian Social Democrats ran their own candidates, they would not, in fact, be taking votes away, would not make it possible for the Black Hundreds to actually win. And he was very confident that, in looking at the election returns from the first elections for the first Duma, and he was correct. He was correct, and so the Russian Social Democrats made important gains in that second Duma elections. And the outcome of that is, this is when we begin seeing the liberals beginning to back away from the already limited opportunities in the electoral process, and so they begin to take more and more authoritarian, anti-democratic measures to place limits on the electoral process. But that created a big debate amongst the Bolsheviks about whether or not do you participate in elections or not. That was one of the first big splits within the Bolsheviks about the elections. Of those who said we should boycott the elections versus Lenin's argument, that we should participate. Lenin would admit later that it was a mistake for the Bolsheviks to have boycotted the first Duma election. He went along with it very reluctantly, but he says in 1920 in Left Wing Communism, it was a mistake to have boycotted. And the problem with the debate was, and it was something that it was still very early in the history of our movement historically, that is, when do you know a movement or a revolutionary process is in the ascent or in the descent? And Lenin's argument was, yes, it was correct to boycott as long as the movement was in the ascent, because you know that the ruling class wants to use election to direct energy away from the streets into the electoral process. But once the movement is in the descent, then it was obligatory for revolutionaries to participate in the electoral process. Well, that was a big debate in a split within the Bolsheviks around this very question of boycott. All right. One other thing from 1905, 1906, it's important, and that is the work that the Bolsheviks were doing, the Mensheviks as also, but the work they were doing inside the military, working inside the military, doing political work inside the military. Boy, that would pay off. That would really pay off in 1917. Having had that experience working inside the military and taking the elections to the Soviets, when the Soviets return in 1917, taking elections to the Soviets, not only to the Dumas, but also to the Soviets. And so counting the votes, counting your forces, being able to count when to take power, when to carry out the armed struggle. That's the importance of counting forces, using elections, again, not as an end in themselves, but as a means to an end. The other things I could say, I mentioned to Josh, and maybe we can take it up during the Q&A, what is the relevance of these ideas to politics today, and obviously what I know better, the U.S., the Trump phenomenon. I've written something about the Trump phenomenon, what happened on January the 6th, the elections in the United States and so on, the lesser evil question, all the debates within the left. And so I've written on the topic, trying to utilize ideas from the book to try to make sense about developments that are taking place within the U.S. today. So I'll just mention that, and again, we can take it up during the discussion.
Well, if you'd like to elaborate on some of that now as well, we've got some time for that, August. But yeah, did you want to go into some of that now?
Yeah, regarding the current situation in the U.S.?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Yeah, one, a lot of yeses in this room.
Yeah, an example, a very outstanding example of parliamentary cretinism was the Trump impeachment trial. And if you follow the Trump impeachment trial, boy, you'd come away from it believing that, yeah, what happened in Congress? Congress was the center of democracy in the United States. So what happened on January the 6th was a threat to U.S. democracy. Talk about parliamentary cretinism. That was on striking display with the impeachment trial of Trump, and that's because again people subscribe to voting fetishism, and the striking thing to me about January the 6th was that only about 400 people of the 74 million people who voted for Trump, only about 400 were willing, maybe, to try to impose their will on the majority, the hundreds of millions of people in the United States. That was not a threat. United States, the Democratic Project, which is still a work in progress, it was not threatened by 400 people, that motley crew of 400. But the trial itself of Trump gave that, or tried to paint the picture that democracy was under threat, and that these 400 people there were the apocalypse had arrived, a catastrophic reading of the political process. Again, the tendency on both the left and the right to confuse voting with the actual exercise of power. To exercise power means to impose your will. And my argument is that power is exercised on the picket line, in the streets, on the battlefield, in the barricades. That's where power is actually exercised. And those 400 who invaded the Capitol, this was not a threat. In a country like the United States, where the majority of the population is able to exercise basic democratic rights, like the right to public assembly, that exists. That's real. That exists within the United States. And so, but yes, that's the both the left and the right have this fetish about voting. Yeah, I also look at Trump and the lessons of 1848, Bonapartism, Marx and Engels' analysis of Bonapartism. And I argue that there was never a Bonapartist moment in the United States because no wing of the ruling class was willing to overturn the elections. And the reason for that is that we have to admit the reality in the United States is that the working class is not a threat. The working class is not in motion here. It's no threat to the ruling class, the way it was in 1848, 1849, leading up to Louis Bonaparte's coup d'etat in December of 1851, and there's no better witness to how the ruling class was thinking, especially the liberal wing, than Alexis de Tocqueville. De Tocqueville played a major role in helping to encourage. To give license to Bonaparte to carry out his his coup d'etat. Tocqueville is the prototype for what happens to a liberal in a real Bonapartist moment. Exactly his fear. The great thing about Tocqueville, he's very honest. You see, he fears the mob. It was this mob, especially the socialist mob, and especially what they were doing in the elections. As the socialists were winning in these elections, yeah, this frightened the ruling class, people like de Tocqueville, and he would rather hold his nose and take what Marx called a grotesque mediocrity, Louis Bonaparte, rather than see the masses in power. So my argument is that, it was never a Bonapartist moment like that here in the United States, because the reality, we have to admit, the working class is not a threat. It's not a threat to the... There will be a time. There will be a time, of course, where that will happen, and there will be a Bonapartist moment. But that wasn't the case during the Trump presidency.
Yeah, I agree with, and August also written a really good article. People could find online about a bunch of those questions, understanding the current, the 6th of January events and so on. And we've also written in Red Flag similar kind of analysis about how, the talk about a Trump coup was always massively overplayed, because the reality is the ruling class were backing the Democrats and Biden and the whole state apparatus. By and large, we're backing a Biden presidency. They think that Biden and the Democrats are the best pair of hands to run U.S. capitalism at the moment, to try to shore up U.S. imperialism, to deal with their rivals in China, to restore some semblance of political stability at home, and so on. So that is the key determinant, as August said, not like anything else. So that meant that any talk of a Trump coup, and you got to see, was being a lot of it cynically mobilized by the Democrats, just to herd the left into supporting them yet again, into that dead end of lesser evilism that we've talked about. And unfortunately, you could see that play out in a number of ways. And of course, a key role played in that by the more left-wing Democrats, by Bernie Sanders and all them, who became just the real campaign people for Biden at the end of the day, as did Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and so on. And then you had sections of the left, like the DSA and so on, who you can see a clear example, I think, of parliamentary cretinism in the way that they totally prioritised their electoral work even over the Black Lives Matter rebellion. There was tens of millions of people mobilising in the streets. You would think that is where you would find many of the radicalising young people that should form the raw materials of a growing socialist movement in America. But that is not really where a lot of people focus their energies, and instead the pull back to supporting a lesser evil so-called Democrat, played out. But I'll stop there, so there's plenty of time for discussion.
Can I just add to that, I don't want to give the impression that we should ignore or dismiss or to belittle what the 400 did on January the 6th. My argument is that we should see it as a wake-up call. We should see it as a wake-up call and see what it actually happened, but to take it as a wake-up call in order for progressive forces to be able to organize themselves and take serious what Lenin argued for as early as 1901. That is, if the Revolutionary Party doesn't have a party in place, if the Revolutionary Party does not have an organization in place, it would be too late. It would be too late to try to form one, a revolutionary party, in the middle of all of the tumult. That was Lenin's insight in 1901. And I argue that that insight in 1901 goes a long way in explaining why the Bolsheviks outdistanced every other current within Russia.
Thanks for that, August. Did you want to add anything else before we move on to the discussion?
That's for me?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. No, I think underscoring the importance of doing political work inside the military. Inside the military is something that every revolutionary socialist should think about. and ponder and realize what the Bolsheviks were able to do. And boy, I can't tell you, leading up to October, Lenin is counting all kinds of voting, not only in the Dumas, but also in the Soviets. And it's on this basis that Lenin determines when is the time to carry out the armed struggle. And this goes a long way in explaining why it was such a peaceful affair. In Petrograd, the October Revolution, October-November Revolution, was a relatively peaceful affair. Maybe about 11 or 12 people lost their lives. And the reason it was is because it was so well organized. It was so well organized. And the army and the sailors had come over to the side of the Bolsheviks. And how did the Bolsheviks know that? The elections in the Soviets. We now have, by the way, there's a Russian scholar who was able to find a trove of correspondence of soldiers and sailors a couple of years ago, and she was able to look at those letters and to calculate and to assemble data on the elections that were taking place in the Soviets of soldiers and sailors, and to show how indeed the Bolsheviks emerged as the top party, the leading party in the Soviets. And the reason for it is because of the war. Exactly because of the war, the First World War, and the slaughter that was taking place, and the popularity of the Bolsheviks. But again, we should take serious what Lenin said in 1920 in left-wing communism, that work was indispensable. That's the word he uses. That work in the parliamentary and in the electoral arena was indispensable for understanding why the Bolsheviks were able to take power. One of the things I do in my book is I want to make sure that we prioritize Lenin's voice. Unlike the major Leninologists who prioritize their own voices, I prioritize Lenin's voice. And in the appendix, I provide appendices that provide documents to support the claims that I'm making. And if you don't have time to read the book, I encourage people to go to the appendix and read the thesis on revolutionary parliamentarism. And Lenin, I should have mentioned it, Lenin calls it revolutionary parliamentarism because he wants to distinguish it from reformist parliamentarism. That's why Lenin calls it revolutionary parliamentarism. But yes, if you don't have time to read the book, go to the appendix and read the thesis on revolutionary parliamentarism.